Roger. Thanks for that information, sir, and I'll get back to you if we come up with anything. Over.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Beyond the Breakers, a podcast about shipwrecks, loss, and lessons learned from maritime disasters. My name's Tanner. I am one of your hosts today. I'll be joined here by Taylor very shortly. Before we get to all of that, we do have some new patrons to thank in the 2 weeks since we recorded a new main episode. So a big thank you to Klaus, Leah, and Jill for joining us over on Patreon. We've got some great new stuff coming out this month in March. And of course, you've got the back catalog of bonus episodes to enjoy as well. Thanks for your support. And yeah, we can move on and bring in Taylor. How's it going, Taylor?
Oh, pretty good. Pretty good. The weather is back to how it's supposed to be, I guess, in March in Ohio. It's a little chilly and dreary and rainy today.
I had my classroom windows open up today, but yeah, it has definitely cooled down from like the 65 degrees it was last week. They had to put out a warning, like a notice.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was in Madison because people kept falling through the ice on the lake. And it's like, dude, it was 60 degrees like 2 days ago.
Mm-hmm.
Don't go on the ice.
Yeah, no thank you. Yeah, it's a little more back to what I expect it to be in March now.
Aside from that, what have you been up to? I see that your media check-in is titled Clan Pilled.
Yeah, you know, like you go down a rabbit hole and you start reading books.
Sometimes I read books.
Yeah, that happens sometimes. So I've read a book called The Second Coming of the KKK. The Ku Klux Klan of the 1920s by Dr. Linda Gordon.
Mm.
She actually was a professor at Wisconsin at one point, so that's cool.
Since you were saying how good it was, I ordered that book as well, so I have it downstairs.
So it kind of examines the second iteration of the KKK, and which what's kind of cool is like I didn't really know what the difference was, and this book does a great job of kind of spelling all of that out. And the answer is it's much more northern and much more Midwestern than like you would ever really believe.
Wasn't like the restarted one founded in Indiana?
Yeah, basically. Evansville is kind of where a lot of it begins. I think technically Georgia, I can't remember, but Indiana becomes the like hot seat of power.
A lot of people associate the South with racism and like for good reason historically. But the fact is like it has just been a nationwide thing.
It provides a pretty broad view of the time period, and it does a good job of really documenting like the beginning, the middle, and the end. One thing I like, and one thing that she's very upfront about in the beginning of the book, is that she's coming at it academically and not morally. And she doesn't spend any time saying, well, this is so bad that they did this thing, or you know, this person was bad. She's presenting it to you as it existed at the time. Like she's assuming you're smart enough to know that the KKK is bad without her having to tell you that. So it's very academically written, but it was really good, and it was a great overview, and I'm glad I read that first, because that led me into a book called A Fever in the Heartland by Timothy Egan. It's the KKK's plan to take over America and the woman who stopped them. It focuses on kind of a more personal story of the second version of the Klan. And in particular, it follows the rise of D.C. Stevenson, who's one of the big names in the Klan at the time, kind of the guy in the state of Indiana. And his fall.
Was he the Grand Dragon?
Wizard,
Grand Kleagle?
Dragon,
Grand
something.
Wizard?
They break down some of the names. There's so many stupid names.
The Grand Clump.
And it follows his downfall after the murder of Madge Oberholzer. So it's really good. It's written a little more narratively, and it's definitely a little bit more true crime, but it's not. It's still very history focused.
Mm-hmm.
It's really good. I would also recommend reading that one at some point.
Hmm.
So yeah, I have learned a lot about 1920s KKK. On a lighter note, college basketball conference tournaments have started. It's great to have to sweat out an overbet against the number 11 and number 8 seeds in the Atlantic Sun Conference, right? Like that's usually at like 11 a.m. or something like that. You'll get a game like that. It's fun. It's a good time for everybody.
I've chosen Providence as my team this year just because every time I turn on Fox Sports 1, it's always Big East basketball. And it seems like every time I turn it on, it's always Providence. So I was like, you know what? I might as well just start going for Providence. So they're my guys now.
I'm shooting for a Marquette UNC final, like always.
I'm bleeding silver and black. I'm a friar till the end.
Is it St. John's who has the mascot that flaps its wings the entire time?
I don't know. What is St. John's mascot?
It's a red bird of some sort.
Is it Rick Pitino? He kind of looks like a bird.
He kind of does.
Yeah, for me, I've been doing my same books that I've been reading for a century, it seems like. The Ian Toll Pacific Crucible and Gravity's Rainbow. And so those are going well. I'm almost done with the Ian Toll.
Nice.
But aside from that, Katie and I have been watching Air Disasters on Paramount.
Uh-huh. I like that.
Because it comes on Smithsonian occasionally and we'll catch one. And we decided that that's just something we should just watch from the beginning. And so it's fun to see some episodes that we have heard, you know, once or even multiple times on podcasts.
Mm-hmm.
Take to the Sky. And then before that, Black Box Down.
RIP Rooster Teeth.
And so some of these stories I've heard, you know, 3-4 times. But for some reason, Air Disasters, and I think it's because the planes aren't named per se. Mm-hmm. They never stick with me, so I have the hardest time remembering the fine details of Air Disasters. And so it's just been a lot of fun to see them in a different way, presented visually. The acting is kind of hit or miss on some of those.
Yeah, that is definitely one where sometimes the acting's pretty good, and then other times I'm like, oh, not good. And it's not even season dependent either. That's the thing.
It has been fun. I mean, that the story of an air disaster is very similar to the story of a shipwreck in that there's always kind of one thing that it hinges on. And what does the industry do with that information after? Mm-hmm. Does it lead to any sort of changes? So, yeah, that's what we've been up to.
Nice.
Aside from that, been a while since we recorded. A lot of stuff has happened in the world. Most of it bad. In Gaza, in the ongoing genocide in Gaza, the confirmed deaths are up above 30,000. Of course, the real number is probably significantly higher than that that's been recorded. On a related note, this is the first time we've recorded since the death of U.S. Air Force serviceman Aaron Bushnell, who self-immolated in front of the Israeli embassy in Washington, D.C. Is that what it was?
I believe so. Consulate or embassy. I don't know what the difference is or if it, what was what.
By this point, if you've wanted to see the video, you've seen the video. Regardless, you've seen the news about it. Yeah. And like, there's not much else I think to really that we can really say about Aaron Bushnell. Great act of desperation when, you know, nothing else seems to be working. Message wise, I like to think that he galvanized the community in some sense, because this is something that has happened before, unfortunately, for various causes, you know, most famously in Vietnam, but also, you know, just was it last year that climate scientist self-immolated?
Yeah, I think in Atlanta.
And yeah, in December, there was the other one for Gaza. So yeah, it's one of those things where it is just a radical act of protest that is just inherently hard to fathom. So yeah, I don't think we have a lot to add to the discourse about it, but yeah, I just wanted to mention that that happened and just kind of seeing where you hope that an act like that doesn't, you know, go to waste or get normalized in the sense that, you know, we should be shocked by that. Just like, you know, any of the pictures coming out of Gaza, that those things should continue to shock us. And if they stop shocking us, then, you know, we've kind of lost our way as a species. Today brings us to Scotland for the story of the Ro-Ro passenger ferry Princess Victoria. This one has actually been on the schedule for a long time. This has probably been the longest that an episode has sat on the wait list. One of the main sources of this episode is the loss of the MV Princess Victoria from a 2013 issue of the Dublin Historical Record by James Scannell. I think I'm saying his name right.
Scannell.
Could be. I don't know. More of the specific information about passengers and crew came from the loss of the MV Princess Victoria by John Jackson from Northern Irish Roots.
I'm picturing Roots like the Roots we know here in America, but like with Northern Irish people.
Like the band?
Like the show or the miniseries Roots.
Oh, I thought you meant like the Philadelphia hip hop group, The Roots.
That would also be fine. That's U2. U2 is Northern Irish roots.
U2's not from Northern Ireland, are they?
Are they from real Ireland?
They're from regular Ireland, I think.
Are they? Maybe so.
Although with Bono's statements on Gaza, I don't know if they'll claim him.
Where is he? Yeah, he was born in Dublin, so yeah, I guess he's real Irish. Spiritually, I feel like he's Northern Irish.
Not that Northern Ireland isn't real Ireland. It belongs to the Republic.
This is true.
The longest and by far the most detailed source of information was the book Death in the North Channel by Stephen Cameron. It's not a huge book, but it's insanely detailed.
Hmm.
I'm holding up my book sideways to Taylor in the camera.
Yeah, that isn't very big.
You can see it's quite skinny, but it is also, it's like magazine dimensions.
Yeah.
But it's very, very detailed. The area we're going to be focused on today is the northern edge of the Irish Sea between Great Britain and Ireland, the area known as the North Channel. We're looking specifically at the ferry route between Stranraer in Scotland and Larne in Northern Ireland. And I'm 95% sure I'm saying Stranraer correctly. I watched a few videos of people with various accents saying it on YouTube. Stranraer is located about 40 miles west of Kirkcudbright, the home port of the scallop dredger Solway Harvester that we covered back in episode 50, about 2 years ago at this point.
That's pretty crazy. I can't believe that episode's that old.
It's a bit south of the area we were in for the Paisley Canal disaster. Starting in 1872. Now, our main story is going to happen in January of 1953, so we have some ground to cover here.
Mm-hmm.
Starting in 1872, this route between Stranraer and Larne was covered by the paddle steamer Princess Louise, named for the fourth daughter of Queen Victoria, and she was operated by the Larne and Stranraer Steam Packet Company. Stephen Cameron describes the Princess Louise as follows.
She had an iron hull and was 211 feet long, with coal boilers to feed steam to the engines that turned the paddles. Her internal arrangements were designed to be the highest possible standard, with accommodation for passengers situated at the aft of the ship. The walls and ceiling of the passenger saloon were heavily paneled and included stained glass windows.
So there's some fancy stuff here for just being a ferry for this short little jump. Stained glass windows, pretty cool. In 1875, she was followed by a second vessel, the Princess Beatrice.
Is that the next daughter in line?
Yeah, it is. It's the fifth and youngest daughter. So in 1890, a third vessel began service. This one, a 280-foot steel-hulled paddle steamer, the Princess Victoria. She operated until being replaced by the second Princess Victoria in 1912. A big year for ships.
Yeah, that is a big year.
This one was 300 feet long with screw propulsion taking over for the older paddle wheels.
Okay, so much more what we conceive of as a modern ship design.
Her maiden voyage was actually April 29th, 1912.
April was a big month in 1912 for ships.
So this is just about 2 weeks, or exactly two weeks, after the Titanic had sunk.
Nowhere I'd rather be than a Ro-Ro ferry right after the Titanic sank.
Well, I think this is probably before the time when Ro-Ro ferries really have this reputation.
That's true. Everything's still kind of dangerous at this point. So,
in Death in the North Channel, Stephen Cameron actually recounts an anecdote of at least one passenger refusing to board the Princess Victoria upon learning that this was a maiden voyage. So people are very leery about being on a ship's first voyage around this time. In October 1914, she was pressed into military service, but she actually made it through the First World War unscathed and served until 1933.
Served until 1933?
Yes.
Huh. I'm surprised she didn't get used a little longer. I feel like that was right when things were about to gear up again.
Oh, yeah, that's coming here, too. So in 1923, the route between Stranraer and Larne had been taken over by the London, Midland, and Scottish Railway. And in July of 1939, a new ferry went into service, the MV Princess Victoria.
Is this the third Princess Victoria?
This is the third one. So this edition was 310 feet long, diesel powered, and could carry 1,400 passengers.
Is this our Princess Victoria? In the sense that this is the one that we will be talking about today.
Have you ever seen the movie Beerfest?
Yes.
You know how the one character drowns in the vat of beer?
Yes.
And then he gets replaced by his identical twin?
Uh-huh.
And he just asks them to call him by his dead twin's name?
Yeah.
It's kind of what happens here. So this Princess Victoria, one of her revolutionary features was she had doors at the stern for cars to drive on and off. This wasn't
like,
a thing.
Like you could roll them on.
And hopefully roll them off on the other end.
Okay.
Before this, you know, cars had not been prevalent enough that you would have needed a car ferry. And she actually had space for 80 cars on the car deck. I thought this was, it seemed like a crazy high number of cars.
It has a lot of cars.
For the time. The idea that there would be 80 cars that needed to go on this route. And there's actually a turntable on the car deck so that cars could be turned around and driven off when disembarking. If you compare to the more modern style where you have kind of the drive-through style ferry, where you can enter, you know, at the stern and drive off through the bow. And so this allowed the ship to, you know, not have to, or the cars could be driven forward on and off. Bit of an aside, but from the Scannell, the Dublin Historical Record article, I learned that Ro-Ro ferries are actually a lot older than I thought they were.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently the idea was first sort of designed in the 1850s. I don't know. It seems really early.
I mean, I feel like almost like as soon as you really figure out railroads, you have to figure out how you're going to solve the next problem, right?
For something that we can't even make safe now. It was designed by Sir Thomas Bouche. I don't know how to say this guy's name. The same guy who designed the Tay Bridge.
Interesting.
Very famously collapsed in 1879 with a whole train full of passengers on it.
That's episode 93 of Well, There's a Problem, just in case you were curious.
So if your ears perked up hearing 1939, yes, the Princess Victoria also would see some military service. She only got about 2 months into her passenger career until she was pressed into service in September of 1939. She was actually converted into a mine layer, now HMS Princess Victoria. She didn't carry that name for very long because in 1940, returning home from a mine-laying mission off the coast of the Netherlands, she struck a mine in the Humber estuary and sank, killing 36 of her crew.
Oh, no.
How the turntables.
That is something. Like, you mentioned being the captain and like calling that in. Like, guys, you're not going to believe what happened.
It's called karma. And I kind of got sidetracked reading about this, but the Kriegsmarine had actually undertaken something called Operation Viking in late 1939 into 1940, where they laid about 1,800 mines off the east coast of Britain. It's just kind of interesting comparing that to like World War One, where the German Navy's kind of hemmed in the whole time.
Right.
And here they're able to just lay mines up and down the coast.
Yeah,
of Britain.
A lot. They're a lot more active.
One person who did survive that sinking was her captain, James Ferguson. We're going to see him again.
Okay. Chekhov's Ferguson.
Chekhov's Scott. Nearing the end of the war in 1944, London, Midland, and Scottish Railway decided to order a replacement vessel built to the same specifications as her predecessor. She was just an exact copy.
So is this Princess Victoria 4?
Yes, and this is the one that they're ordering now that we are going to be focused on, finally.
They, like, clone their dead baby, basically?
Yeah, kind of. She'd be constructed by William Denny and Brothers of Dunbarton, as her predecessors had been, and she'd carry the same name, the Princess Victoria. So, after all those fake-outs, we finally get to the focus of our episode.
Now that we're through the first three pages of notes.
31 minutes into recording. The new Princess Victoria, the fourth one, launched in August of 1946 and was delivered for service at Stranraer. Every time I say Stranraer, it sounds like it's wrong, but I know I looked it up. It's just hard to say. Stranraer. It's like the rural juror in 30 Rock. Delivered for service at Stranraer in March of 1947.
Like the previous Victoria, the one striking feature of this new ship was to be the open stern, which would allow cars, lorries, and even a double-decker bus to be driven on and off, making her one of the first of the roll-on, roll-off, or ro-ro type of ferries.
Now, I have questions.
Mm-hmm.
Who is trying to take a double-decker bus on this?
I mean, I guess if you built it on...
Why? Do they even use those outside of, like, London?
I don't know. I kind of assumed it was just for fun.
Like, is it a normal thing?
It could have been back in the day.
Maybe. It's true.
It was probably more common.
Do you need that? Like, the car deck on Princess Victoria was 170 feet long and spanned the entire width of the ship. I mean, this is pretty normal for a ro-ro ferry.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, highlighting the consistent issue with these ferries, if you've never listened to one of these episodes about ro-ros or you don't know anything about them, having a big open space that you can't make watertight is a terrible thing for a ship to have.
If you want to, like, practice, take a pie tin and, like, fill it halfway with water and then walk around your house and see how long you can go without spilling the water.
It's a terrible thing to have on a ship. But, I mean, if you're trying to put cars on this thing, you don't really have a choice. There's no real way to compartmentalize things or seal things off. The doors at the stern for closing off the car deck, they were about 5 feet 7 inches high. They were about one tanner high, these doors, or 1.7 meters in height. And so one thing, I forgot to put the detail in the note here, there was also this sort of screen thing that they could put down to cover the gap, because they're closing these doors, and this is not a watertight seal by any means at the back. It's at the stern, so the idea being that, well, hopefully not that much water comes over the stern.
Mm-hmm. And we've definitely talked about that before with this type of vessel as well.
And everything will be fine. Kind of like we talked about with the SS Milwaukee having that sort of kind of open back door. So entering the section called accidents on the notes, just like we had multiple Princesses Victoria to talk about here, we also have multiple accidents now that we are at our Princess Victoria. This is a high bang to buck ratio for this episode. So the first noteworthy accident was in November of 1949, when the Princess Victoria was crossing from Larne to Stranraer. Her cargo, you ask?
Mm-hmm.
16 milk tankers.
Oh.
Each weighing 10 tons and carrying 1,500 to 2,000 gallons of milk.
It's a lot of milk.
This is the milk truck. We are hauling milk. James Scannell will narrate the rest of this little incident here.
The force 8 to 9 gale blowing at the time caused the ship to roll from side to side, resulting in some of the tankers sliding towards the port side. Two of the tankers overturned on their side, broke loose from their chassis, and gave the ship a list of 10 degrees.
Senior Officer Leslie Oldsworth ran onto the car deck and decided that the immediate priority was to dispose of the milk in the hope of reducing the list. He opened the valves on 4 of the tanks and allowed up to 6,000 gallons of milk to flood onto the car deck, which was soon covered to a depth of 9 inches.
Is that supposed to be seawater?
Yes. The milk mixed with the sweater.
The milk mixed with the seawater that had already come onto the car deck via the stern door, as well as the diesel from the tanker's ruptured fuel tanks. Then it began to drain into the engine room, making for an extremely dangerous situation.
Extremely dangerous and really gross.
Like milk, seawater, and diesel fuel. that's not coming out of anything you're wearing either. Like, you're
like, it's a very serious, very dangerous situation, but also it's really funny that you've mixed these three things and it's like a foot deep.
Means it's like in your boots too, like you're walking around in it.
Ever since the accident, I've never been able to tolerate the smell of
milk
and diesel fuel and seawater mixed together. The situation was dealt with by using brooms to sweep the liquid to the scuppers, and you know, they dealt with everything just fine. Again, aside from probably the smell.
Yeah, that can't be good.
The next incident of note was in September of 1950, when the Princess Victoria was docking at Stranraer. She was backing in, so coming in stern first, to the dock, when she was unable to stop before striking the pier ramp.
You really want to stop.
You want to be able to do that. So this was despite the fact that she had both engines going full speed ahead to slow her reverse. It doesn't appear that there was any major damage from this event, aside from just the concern over why isn't she handling the way she's supposed to.
Mm-hmm.
In November 1951, there was a third safety incident, and this is actually the first one that's really directly related to what will eventually sink the Princess Victoria. As the ferry was making her approach to Larne, a violent storm blew up with what are described as hurricane force winds. So as mentioned in the previous incident's description, the ferry had to come about so that she approached the dock stern first. That was her normal way of docking. But as she turned in this heavy wind and high seas, she begins to take water onto her car deck, giving her a 10-degree list to starboard.
I think it's interesting that, just like all the others we talk about, how quickly this can happen
mm-hmm.
with this type of vessel.
The TLDR on the Ro-Ro ferry is, if something goes wrong, it tends to go wrong quickly and catastrophically.
Like we've said before, very much like an airplane crash.
Yeah, Ro-Ro incidents tend to have extremely high casualty percentages.
Say no-no to Ro-Ro.
Say rut-ro to Ro-Ro.
And that's funny because that phrase, rut-ro, is exactly what got the first episode done about the Alfaro. Because I was reading the transcripts on Reddit and someone says rut-ro at some point as they sail into the hurricane.
Don't ever say that in a time where you're going to be recorded. So you don't want that to be like one of your last words. Or maybe you do. I don't know.
But to be fair, that is partially what inspired this podcast.
Stockton Rush's last words. So acting captain at the time, Shirley Duckles.
What?
Shirley Duckles.
Shirley Ducks.
That is a man, Shirley Duckles.
This is a British man.
Judged that it was too dangerous to continue attempting to dock at Larne and opted to take the vessel back across the channel to Stranraer. And actually, in that previous incident from September 1950, the one where she struck the pier,
mm-hmm.
Duckles had been the chief officer on board. And that was his position. Here, he's just acting captain for this trip. So back to November 1951, acting chief officer Hay was sent below to investigate the extent of the flooding on the car deck and found that there's about 3 feet of water at the starboard side. And also, he found out how it got there.
Hay discovered that the sea had buckled the stern doors, that the starboard one was open to the sea, but that only the bolts and stays had been damaged and not the door itself. This was eventually closed by crew members using crowbars. Little priority was attached to providing new locking bolts and stays for the stern doors, with the vessel making 2 further complete crossings before these were installed.
So a common theme you'll see, right up until her last voyage, there's not a lot of urgency in getting these things fixed.
No, this is a real safety third vibe.
And I don't know, I think maybe part of that has to do with the fact that her crossing is it's a fairly small
routine
amount of water. Yeah, thinking that, well, surely we can get across here with no major problems.
Mm-hmm.
So Duckles, the acting captain, he was concerned enough about this that he even submitted a report to the Marine Superintendent of British Railways. So there are concerns being raised. This isn't nonchalance on the part of the crew, but more so on the part of the people making the decisions on mm-hmm. these repairs. So the last minor incident before we get to the final one, happened in November of 1952. And for this one, the Princess Victoria isn't actually even in transit. She's actually tied up at the pier in Larne when another vessel, the SS Empire Gaelic, struck her starboard side and tore out her forward moorings. So now that she's no longer securely fastened to the pier, Princess Victoria drifted backwards and her stern struck the ramp. Princess Victoria was taken out of service and sent to Glasgow for an inspection, which found that she had actually taken damage to her bow and her hull, in addition to her stern. More significantly, at least in retrospect, damage had been done to the guide rails on her sliding door, the screen cover thing, which, according to Scannell, could still move up and down, but couldn't be locked in place over the stern doors, as was its original purpose. If you can't lock it in place, then it's not doing its job.
Right. Yeah, it's pretty much a non-functional piece of equipment at that point.
It's great. You can move it up and down, but if it doesn't lock, it's not keeping the water out the way it should.
Funny, because really, I'm sure someone at Boeing at some point was like, I mean, it doesn't quite lock, but this door's not going anywhere.
That ain't going nowhere. The surveyor conducting the inspection recommended that the rails be repaired at the owner's convenience.
That's a man that wants more business from the owner.
Not something that was deemed urgent. You've got to get this fixed right now. Not a lockout tagout situation.
It's like when you don't have a lot of money and you need your car fixed and the mechanic's like, oh, this repair could last a week or could last, you know, 2 years. I don't know. And you're like, we'll find out.
Of course, with that kind of recommendation, we know how these businesses work. The vessels return to service with no repair being done to the sliding door. That being the case, the shield could no longer be lowered to prevent that seawater from spraying onto the car deck. And so that's the thing. This is keeping spray out. So in general, in normal seas, you're going to take some water, but not a concerning amount of water.
Mm-hmm.
The issue becomes, what happens when you get into a heavier sea where you're actually taking waves over the stern? And we're going to find out in the incident. Saturday, January 31st, 1953. The previous evening, around 9 p.m., Princess Victoria had arrived in Stranraer, and by the early morning hours of the 31st, she was being loaded for the trip back to Larne. On a normal trip, she'd carry about 70 tons of cargo, but she had a lighter load this time, with only around 43 tons. Scannell lists the cargo as follows, and I'm including the full list just to get an idea of the really varied nature of what she's carrying here.
110 bags of letter mail, 425 bags of parcel post, 1,000 rail parcels, 2 tons of baggage, 6 boxes of fish, 5 hampers of laundry, 6 drums, 3 bales, 5 cases, 1 parcel, 55 cartons of footwear, 1 skip, 2 crates of textiles, 14 tea chests containing sundry items, 2 boxes of tire covers, 160 bags of brush planks, and 520 sanitary pipes.
The cargo was arranged on the car deck in 40 wood and steel trays, which were lowered onto the vessel by crane. Scannell also describes the arrangement of the cargo.
The sanitary pipes were placed on the starboard side of the car deck and held in place by the cartons of footwear, while the remainder of the cargo in these trays was placed alongside both sides of the car deck, with care being taken to ensure they did not block the scuppers. The 5 laundry hampers and 1 case of methylated spirits were stored on the turntable in the middle of the car deck.
So as you can see, it's kind of like, I don't know, it's kind of like if you've ever had a job where you had to stack pallets.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of got to just kind of work with what you have and figure out the best way of stacking it. Or if you've, you know, packed a truck or something.
I was going to say, like, you've worked with trucks before. So you know how that is when you're working in a trailer, loading or unloading something. Like, you kind of do the things you have to do. You get creative sometimes.
Yeah, most of my experience is with unloading. And it's the people who pack the trucks at the distribution center, you know, at whether it's at Target or a grocery store. Like with my experience, kind of like the umpire in baseball, or the long snapper in football, where if they do their job well, you don't really appreciate them that much. Mm-hmm. And you only really notice them when you're like,
what were you doing?
What the hell were you doing here? What is this? So there was one car to be loaded. I was curious about this. They're using all the space on the car deck for this regular cargo. There's one car to be loaded, but due to the high winds, the decision was made to wait and send it on the next trip across the channel.
It's a good decision.
I actually don't remember whose car it was and if they went and if they survived. So may not have needed the car anymore. 5:30 a.m., a train arrived from London with a final group of passengers for the ferry, and final preparations are made to sail with a total complement of 177. That's passengers and crew together. And that's an estimate. You know, this is still, they're not exactly sure. Everyone's best guess, about 177. It was noted that with this kind of route, this sort of, you know, everyday back and forth route, that some people, you know, seeing the weather forecast, which was not good, easily could have decided just not to take the ferry.
Just to wait a day.
I can sympathize with that feeling.
Right.
Especially now, knowing what we know about Ro-Ros. So just after 8 a.m., the Princess Victoria pulled away from the dock and made her way into Loch Ryan. Loch Ryan is the body of water that Stranraer is at the bottom of, that you go up, you know, north out into the Irish Sea, the North Channel. Around 9 a.m., Princess Victoria is exiting Loch Ryan into the Irish Sea. And now we have to talk about the weather.
I know you had mentioned it was windy.
Very windy. And it was also noted here that this is the transition where, you know, going from this protected body of water, Loch Ryan, into, you know, the open sea. This is a change that you would feel even on like a normal day. You'd notice the difference in the sea. And this is not a normal day. We already mentioned those high winds. It's just going to get worse. BBC had initially issued a gale warning the previous day, and another was issued at 6:55 a.m. on the 31st. As she entered the Irish Sea, the Princess Victoria encountered force 9 winds, with wind gusts reaching 60 miles an hour, waves up to 30 feet in height, and visibility of less than 2 miles. Captain Ferguson decided to take the ferry further north and then cross the channel to Larne.
Mm-hmm.
So battling against this weather for about 20 miles before making the decision that they had to turn back for Stranraer. As we saw in that previous story, where these things are close enough where in situations where it just got too rough,
you could go back.
They were able to just turn around and go back. So quoting here from Miriam Bibby, writing for historicuk.com.
As the bow of his vessel nosedived into the trough of one of the immense waves, throwing passengers and crew about, Captain Ferguson realized that if he attempted to follow the southwesterly heading to Larne, the ship would be beam on to these massive waves, with potentially catastrophic consequences. There was only one option, to attempt to return to Loch Ryan.
And so this kind of highlights sort of the unique vulnerability of this type of vessel. Obviously, in these rough seas, you want to be bow into these waves. No ship wants to take these waves broadside. Mm-hmm. But then there's the additional vulnerability on this vessel where you don't want a following sea either. Because if you're taking waves over the stern, it's going to fill you up very fast. So quoting again here from Scannell,
as the MV Princess Victoria turned round to sail back bow first into Loch Ryan, the stern doors were exposed to the full force of the gale, and an exceptionally heavy wave crashed into the ship, buckled the stern doors, and flooded the car deck. With the stern doors now breached, seawater continued to flood into the ship as wave after wave washed onto the car deck. The scuppers were unable to deal with the large volume of water, which washed in and out as the ship rose and fell with the waves. Soon, the car deck was covered to the depth of 1 foot of water.
And like we talked about the detail of that, the screen thing being broken.
Mm-hmm.
And sure, that probably contributes to it. But at the same time, the stern doors just get smashed here.
Mm-hmm.
Keeping the spray out is almost, if the sea is smashing through the stern doors, I don't know how much it would have mattered if that was locked in place. Maybe it would have made a huge difference. Maybe that would have strengthened it enough to keep those out. But it seems like just overwhelmingly strong seas here. Captain Ferguson sent Chief Officer Duckles, he's back here, to assess the flooding, with some other crew, including Second Officer Leonard and Able Seaman Alec Craig. They tried to force the stern doors closed with a crowbar that had worked previous voyage. But this time it was unsuccessful. I'm assuming the damage was just a lot worse. And so they gave up on this after about 20 minutes of trying. And this is, you know, trying as they're being flooded out of this car deck.
Yeah, it's not like they're just standing there messing with it. Like, this is under pretty intense conditions.
And so not being able to close it, their next thought was, let's move some cargo to try and, you know, block off what we can. That also was not successful. There's just too much water coming in. It's too hard to get anything shifted around. Captain Ferguson's next decision was to attempt to take the ferry back into Loch Ryan stern first. He's concerned about trying to make this turn, exposing the ship even more. And so this is an interesting feature of the ship. The ferry was equipped with a rudder at her bow for exactly this purpose, but that had to be lowered manually and locked into position. It wasn't always deployed. Able Seaman Nelson and McKinnon went forward to release the rudder, but were unable to get it in place due to the waves breaking over the bow. The conditions just don't allow for this emergency measure to be taken. At 9:46, a Morse code radio message went out from the Princess Victoria.
Hove to over mouth of Loch Ryan. Vessel not under command. Urgent assistance of tug required.
So even at this point, where it does seem pretty dire, they're still not issuing an SOS.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're asking for some help, but not quite an emergency. And this message was sent out by Radio Officer David Broadfoot, another name we should remember from this story. After 10 a.m., a series of announcements went out over the ship's PA system, informing passengers of the situation. The first of which was,
"Your attention, everyone. The captain asks you be prepared for heavy rolling. The ship is going through a severe test, but there is no danger. You are quite safe."
At 10:30, the first distress signal was issued, this also in Morse code.
"Princess Victoria to SOS. Princess Victoria, 4 miles northeast of Corswell. Car deck flooded. Heavy list to starboard. Require immediate assistance. Ship not under command."
That phrasing, I think, was new to me. I don't know if I've encountered that before. Ship not under command as part of this, but just to indicate that she isn't responding to instructions and they have no control over the ship.
Yeah, I haven't seen that before either, but I do like it that it kind of helps the potential rescuers have an idea of what they're dealing with.
Mm-hmm. So at this point, the ferry is both listing severely and drifting stern first down the North Channel. Winds are up to about 120 miles an hour, with sleet and snow hampering visibility.
Yeah, that's gross.
Pretty much the worst possible scenario.
It has a very Great Lakes feel to this story, in that you're never far from land, but there it just, that's absolutely meaning you might as well be in the middle of the ocean.
Some similarities also to the Hans Hedtoft episode we did, where you do have a ship that's able to issue an SOS call and even, you know, converse with other ships, and just the conditions don't allow any sort of rescue in that story. So at 11, the Port Patrick lifeboat, the Jeannie Spears, was launched to assist the Princess Victoria. Port Patrick is about 5 miles southwest of Stranraer in Scotland, but it's on the Irish Sea rather than the protected waters of Loch Ryan, so they have a lifeboat station there. Around the same time, Chief Officer Shirley Duckles was trying to keep passengers calm, telling them that life jackets would be handed out as a precaution.
I mean, I guess to keep people under control, that probably is the best thing to do.
The crew was also preparing lifeboats to be launched. And unfortunately, in those heavy seas, the oars for these lifeboats had mostly been washed away.
Interesting. I have not heard of that being a problem before, but that is, like, it makes a lot of sense.
So the ship was taking more and more water, increasing the starboard list, reaching about 30 degrees. By 11:30, this had worsened to 45 degrees.
That's a lot of degrees.
And life belts had been passed out to all passengers. At this point, some of it says life belts, some sources say life jackets. Maybe it was a mixture of both.
I imagine there's probably both.
The life jackets will definitely play a role here. At 1:08, the Princess Victoria's engines failed. Her engine room had been flooded past the point where they could be restarted. And a general message was sent out from the ferry.
SOS, now stopped. Ship on her beam end.
This was followed shortly after at 1:15, another message from Radio Officer Broadfoot to Port Patrick.
We are preparing to abandon ship.
By this point, the Princess Victoria had made it some way across the channel, putting her a little closer to the Irish side than the Scottish.
Mm-hmm. And this is just because that's where she's being carried again, right?
Yeah, she's drifting. The Donaghadee lifeboat was launched at 1:40 p.m. in hopes that she could get there quicker than the one from Port Patrick. The situation on Princess Victoria continued to get worse. At 1:30, the passengers had been assembled on deck to abandon ship, but because of that severe list, the portside lifeboats couldn't be deployed. They wouldn't have cleared the hull.
Yeah, they would have scraped the hull. Yeah.
We saw the same problem with, well, several ships we've talked about sinking.
Most of the time when you try to deploy lifeboats.
Any ship that's listing, basically. I think we talked about it most with the Lusitania, because you had on the one side, they couldn't be dropped, and on the other side, they were getting dragged under with the ship. The starboard boats were finally launched at 1:50. As soon as I got to this detail in the story, I was like, oh no, this doesn't sound good. All the women and children on board had been placed into lifeboat number 4.
Oh, that's good. That means they're not on the sinking boat anymore.
They're all together.
They're all in one place.
And this is where the story starts to get really bad. Lifeboat 4 made it into the water, but was very quickly thrown back against the ship by the waves. Like
the lifeboat itself was thrown back onto the ship?
Yeah.
Oh.
The boat broke up.
Mm-hmm.
Spilled all of its occupants into the sea. And none of those occupants from Lifeboat 4, so that's none of the women and none of the children who were on board Princess Victoria, survived.
I know we talked about this a lot more early on in the show, but the sea just finds ways to kill women and children.
Well, it's like we talked about in that bonus episode where we kind of looked at some of the statistics of kind of the gender divide between surviving and how with modern maritime incidents, now that the physical aspect has been not totally removed, but more removed than it used to be, you do see less of that disparity. But this is still at the point where you kind of had to be a adult in the prime of your physical condition to have a chance of surviving in many of these cases. Also, I've got this at some point later, but the water is about 4 degrees Celsius.
I thought it would be chilly.
Which is about a little under 40 degrees Fahrenheit. So if you're in the water, you don't have a ton of time. At 1:58, Radio Officer David Broadfoot sent out one final message.
SOS, estimated position now 5 miles east of Copeland's entrance, Belfast Lock.
Broadfoot had been operating the radio nonstop since the beginning of the ordeal. And that final message went out literally in the last possible moments that it could have. Water is coming up around him as he's sending out this message. Just a couple of minutes later, the Princess Victoria completed her roll to starboard and capsized, throwing anyone left on board into the water. Quoting here from Stephen Cameron.
The ship gave a massive lurch and someone shouted, "It's going." And she rolled over onto her side in the water. Those passengers who had not had their grip on the rails, wrenched by the violent movement, tried to climb up and over them. Passengers and crew who had surmounted the rails and still had strength made their way aft along the side and then the keel to try to jump into the lifeboats.
Case in point right here, some of the things that these people have to do just to survive.
Mm-hmm.
This ship is turning over. You're having to pull yourself up over these rails and then traverse the upturned side of the ship. If you're not in good physical condition, or, you know, you've picked up an injury, if you're too small, too weak, too old,
too big,
Yeah, you don't have a good chance of surviving this.
Yeah, I mean, you're doing action movie shit.
So just before 2 o'clock in the afternoon, the Princess Victoria sank completely. This is just a couple of minutes after she had capsized. She's already so full of water. It doesn't take long for her to sink once she's turned
right.
Over. So again, anyone who is in the water didn't have a great chance of survival. The water is so cold. The waves are so high. You know, it's snowing, it's sleeting. If you weren't in a boat or on a life raft, you didn't survive.
Yeah, again, like, this just sounds like such a Great Lakes shipwreck story.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a very similar experience to what that happened with the SS Milwaukee, where, mm-hmm. you know, not many people made it into the boats, and the few people that did, even they didn't have a good time.
So yeah, the ones who made it into the boats, I believe everyone who made it into a lifeboat, with the exception of the women and children,
mm-hmm.
I think everyone who made it into the other lifeboats survived. But, like we said, they don't have any oars. So yes, they're drifting. They can't get anywhere to safety, but also they can't steer to pick other people up.
Oh, that's true.
If you're in the water, you have to get to a boat and get in the boat. They can't come to you. And then also, sort of in classic fashion, Captain Ferguson did go down with the ship. At least one passenger reported him giving a salute, you know, from the bridge as the ship went down.
There's a lot of high drama with, like, the radio operator sending out a message as the water rises up over his hips, you know what I mean? And the captain going down with the ship, like, it's mm-hmm. it is very dramatic.
And yeah, I mean, as a reminder, Captain Ferguson, this is the same captain who was commanding the ship when it was sunk during World War II. Mm-hmm. So this is his second go round with the Princess Victoria sinking under him. Getting into some of the rescue and recovery efforts, one vessel that had responded to Princess Victoria's distress call was HMS Contest, a Royal Navy C-class destroyer that had been in the Clyde River at the time of the call. The Contest had estimated that she'd be on scene by 1 p.m. The distress calls had started about 10:30.
It's a long time.
And she ended up later amending this estimate based on the Princess Victoria's location, estimating that it would be more like 2:15, which ends up being about 15 minutes after she actually sinks. The first vessel on scene to assist was the Orkey, I think it's called, under Captain Hugh Matheson. But as so often happens, she's not able to successfully rescue anyone from the water.
Yeah, that has to be incredibly difficult.
And actually, even though she was coming to the scene for the rescue, she does kind of stumble upon Princess Victoria because the location that she thinks she's at is about 5 miles off.
Oh.
So she's about 5 miles further north than she's expected to be. So fortunately, the Orkey does come across, you know, the wreckage, and she's able to at least try to start picking people up. Kind of like we saw with the Ocean Ranger, rescuing from the water's extremely hard because the people in the water can't do very much to help themselves. It's everyone's cold, tired, probably in shock. So the ladders and ropes that the Orkey uses, no one in the water is able to actually use them.
Mm-hmm.
And the sea's too rough for Captain Matheson to order his own lifeboats deployed, fearing that they would be or smashed against the ship, which he would be fully vindicated in being worried about that. Another vessel on scene was an oil tanker called Pass of Dramochter.
Oh my.
I'm assuming that's how that's pronounced. Pass of under Captain James Kelly, only marginally more successful in her attempts as she's able to at least get a line onto lifeboat number 6, which had more than 30 people in it, but wasn't able to get anyone on board from it due to the wave action, making it dangerous. And then also there was the risk of the boat going under the stern of the larger ship and being caught in her propellers.
Just so many ways for it to go poorly.
Never want that. Scannell gives some further details of the rescue here.
The tanker then stood off from the lifeboat while Captain Kelly called up the Donaghadee lifeboat by radio, requesting it take the survivors on board, which it did. This lifeboat then rescued a lone occupant of lifeboat number 5, and then another man from a raft. HMS Contest managed to rescue 6 men in a lifeboat, and then 2 men from separate rafts. The trawler East Coast recovered 7 people from the sea, 6 of whom were dead and appeared to have been choked by their life jackets. The Port Patrick lifeboat rescued 2 individuals from separate life rafts.
The recovery of bodies from the sea continued for some time, and ultimately over 100 were recovered. Some of those were taken out of the sea, and some of those did wash up on shore. And some of them went, you know, a fair distance away from their wreck site. 8 of them were recovered near the Isle of Man. 3 were recovered off of Derry, and 2 off of Scotland. The final death toll, again, it varies based on what total you're working with, how many are considered dead. Final death toll of 128. I think I also saw 133 as another estimate. What we do know is there's 44 total survivors in those 3 lifeboats and 6 life rafts. 34 of those survivors are passengers. The remaining 10 were crew members. Lifeboat 4 had carried 6 survivors. Only 1 survivor had actually gotten into lifeboat number 5. Because again, you know, if you didn't get in one right away as it was sinking, you didn't really have a chance to.
Mm-hmm.
7 men had survived by clinging to life rafts. And this was just another one of these kind of crazy, but also sort of par for the course in these rescue situations. 2 of those people from the life rafts, they'd actually been rescued thanks to the efforts of bosun's mate Wilfred Warren of the Contest, who actually dove into the sea to tie lines around them so they could just be hauled up into the boat. I think anyone jumping into the sea in this situation is it's a pretty insanely heroic thing to do.
Yeah, that's pretty wild.
The Donaghadee lifeboat, Sir Samuel Kelly, had carried those 33 survivors. Getting into some of the aftermath, the investigations, the legal stuff, the safety aspects. So the official inquiry into the sinking began on March 23rd, 1953. So little under 2 months since it happened. And that was in Belfast. It was conducted by John Campbell and 3 technical assessors, and it produced a full report on the sinking after 25 days in session. One of the major findings, and probably the most obvious to anyone listening, is that her stern doors were not up to the task of keeping out the heavy seas. That was, of course, most likely compounded by the failure to have them repaired after that previous incident. You know, obviously that doesn't help the situation. Another contributing factor was the size and number of scuppers on her car deck, found to be insufficient to deal with large amounts of water the Princess Victoria had dealt with that day. And the report found the owners of the vessel, the British Transport Commission, to be entirely responsible. So no blame was placed on her builders. No blame was placed on the crew for this incident. It was all put on ownership, which I think is a fair assessment of the situation, especially if we know that the crew is raising concerns about this. They're writing letters to people saying, hey, I think we need to get this fixed.
Mm-hmm.
So we like to find silver linings when we can in these stories, usually related to safety. And it actually did result in the issuing of new instructions for life jacket use.
It was noted during the inquiry that some deaths were due to the incorrect usage of life jackets by the deceased. The jackets were not held down and consequently were pushed upwards on impact with the water and broke their wearers' necks.
That's something we have seen before, is people not being informed or not being aware of how to use one of these life jackets. You know, probably something that the crew of the vessel is familiar with.
We see this. We see the broken neck. And then the other thing you see is that it turns you over in the water.
Yes,
if you wear it improperly. and you end up just being face down in the water.
Yeah, you have to fight the life jacket to mm-hmm. stay afloat, which is the opposite of what it's supposed to do. In terms of compensation, there was a scale of amounts that would be paid out based on the relationship of the claimant to the deceased. £4,500 for the loss of a husband. A son or daughter would get you £1,200. A wife, £750. Ouch.
The wife's worth less than the kid, your son or daughter.
Guess. A child, £300. So I assume this means like a young child.
I would assume that it's probably like, are they of working age or not?
Like your son or daughter. If they're mm-hmm. even if they're like an adult, I guess you're getting this paid out.
So we know that no wives survived, so none of them got to collect that $4,500, huh?
Well, I guess some of the husbands' wives wouldn't did because they there. Wouldn't have been on it.
Yeah.
So yeah, some of those were paid out. But of course, like any of these, there's some red tape that goes along with these payouts.
Mm-hmm.
So quoting here from Scannell.
When deciding on the level of award to be paid for a wife who had been lost, the High Court decided that if she was not a wage earner, the husband could only claim a sum representing the value of her services to him. Minors only received their awarded compensation when they reached 21, in accordance with the law at the time, with inflation diminishing the amount they actually received when they came of legal age.
So if you were, I don't know, 5 years old when this happened?
Yeah, you're getting a lot less money later on.
I don't know how this was decided of, you know, how much is your wife's services worth to you? I don't know how this is measured. So there are some, there's a lot. This is a very well-documented wreck. And the survivor recollections and individual stories, I'm going to spin off into a bonus episode for this month.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was hard to, I mean, this is a long episode as is. It was hard to fit the stuff I wanted to fit in here, but just not quite enough to warrant two episodes, I think. But I want to cover those in the bonus episode because there has been a lot of work that's gone into documenting this stuff. I mean, just mm-hmm. in the Stephen Cameron book, Death in the North Channel, there's so much. There's just like a minute levels of detail about, and there's so many interesting stories here with the crew and the passengers. So I do want to give some more attention to those. And can do that in a bonus episode. In terms of memorials and how this is remembered. In terms of memorials and how this is remembered. I said, you know, remember David Broadfoot. So for his actions in manning that radio until literally the last possible moment, he was giving up any chance that he had of getting out. Mm-hmm. So he continued to issue these SOS calls. He was posthumously given a George's Cross, which to me seems kind of comparable to like the Presidential Medal of Freedom in mm-hmm. the U.S.
Like a high level, like the highest like civilian award.
Yeah, like kind of the highest non-military honor you can get. Broadfoot spent 6 hours at the radio sending out a total of 54 messages. As of 2013, the date of Scannell's publication, that medal was on display at the Stranraer Museum, having been donated by David Broadfoot's son, Bill, at the memorial function for that. Bill stated,
"The medal has come home as Stranraer deserves the honor. My father was not the only brave man that day, and it is appropriate that future generations can look at the medal and say that he was one of them. The George Cross had significance beyond family pride. People have asked me why I gave it away. It is our pride, but it's also the town's pride."
And that's a good point there, too. This is a local ferry route. The people on this vessel, passengers and crew, were, by and large, locals.
Yeah, from there.
Coming from these communities. So it is a big deal, you know, in terms of remembering the sinking. 2003 marked the 50th anniversary of the sinking. So several of the articles I found were from 2003. A lot from 2013, also for the 60th anniversary. I guess that means that last year would have been the 70th anniversary. There was also a memorial dedicated to the sinking in Donaghadee, Northern Ireland. And there are several memorials, other places, including one at Port Patrick in Scotland. And, you know, for as much as this is a well-documented wreck, it doesn't quite have the name recognition or the attention that some other sinkings have. I know in the area, certainly, you know, in the UK, in Ireland, I'm sure it's well remembered, but it's kind of remembered as a missed opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the early Ro-Ro incidents, but there's many, many more that happen for similar reasons. We've seen several of them just on the episodes we've done. And it's interesting how early in their commercial use, we're fully aware of these massive shortcomings and risks that they pose. Scannell lists the sinkings of the Speedlink Vanguard, Herald of Free Enterprise, and of course the Estonia, as later examples of Ro-Ro sinkings owing to a failure to ensure that car decks remain watertight. Yeah, it's just not something you can play around with on these big ships with these huge open spaces. So, to sum things up here, a final quote from Scannell.
It is no wonder that many maritime experts still consider Ro-Ro ferries and high-rise cruise ships, which often carry around 6,000 passengers and crew, are accidents waiting to happen, despite all of the recent developments in maritime safety. It would appear that the lessons learned from the loss of the MV Princess Victoria in January 1953, the disaster that time forgot, still have not been heeded.